The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
Let's go ahead and let's get started. This apologetics that you fuel for discipleship. And so I want to start out with a quote from Luis Antony, a book he wrote in 2007 called Philosophers Without Gods. And this is what he said. He said, "If I asked my Protestant friends what they believed, they seemed not to have a clue. And in some cases, they were unclear even as to which denomination they belonged. Several of my friends reported that they attended their church. They attended the church they did because their parents liked the minister there." Right? Because that's the reason that we show up at churches, because our parents like the minister. It's being facetious. You get that later. But this is if we all are willing to be transparent, this isn't surprising to us. And that's the sad reality we live in, because we represent, for the most part, the leadership. And we know this to be true. And Luis Antony, in his book, about 285 pages of testimony from philosophers who once held to some type of theism or belief in God's existence who are now atheists. And this is one of the most powerful quotes that whenever I was reading through this book, that it kind of a, you know, Bon Jovi came back to mind, shot to the heart, right? Shot to the heart and you're to blame. Because that should be a shot to our heart, right? One that we are to a point that we recognize it's true. We're not even willing to defend against it. But two, that we've allowed this to kind of get here, because it doesn't happen overnight, right? And so we know that there's a problem, right? But what makes this a bigger problem is this. In 2016, Barna Research did a study, and this is what they found. Most people in this country identify as Christian. Almost three quarters of Americans, 73%, said that they are Christian, while only one-fifth claim no faith at all. That includes atheists, which is no God, no belief in a God, and agnostics. We're not really certain. We're not going to make a decision. We don't care. We just kind of go through life. So you can recognize what the problem may be, because Luis Antony wrote in 2007 something I think that we would mostly affirm. 2016, Barna says that three quarters of America thinks they're Christians. Right? That's an issue. That's an issue. I was preaching this past Sunday, and was preaching on back to the basics, and just this idea that we have this issue of spiritual apathy in the church in America. How do we get back to where we're supposed to be, right? Let's get back to the basics. And so I threw some questions out in that message. So what could be the issue, right? Just potentials. What could be the issue while we're not seeing biblically based Christianity or Christ-centered community, Christ-centered gospel, centered ministry, you know, and all the terms we could throw in that. One of the questions I asked right off the gate, because I think it's a question we really need to ask, is, or kind of a reality, is that it's possible that a lot of the people in the church are not Christians. They're lost. They may profess faith in Christ, and they may have walked the aisle, they may have prayed a prayer, they may have been baptized, they may have even grown up in the church, they may even be a deacon, pastor, or even a Sunday school teacher. And they could be going to hell. Right? And I know that's kind of a taboo thing to say, but Jesus said it for me in Matthew 7, 21 through 23, when he says, "Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, is going to enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven." Right? And then they make the argument, they're like, "Wait a minute, we drove out demons in your name, right? We performed miracles in your name. We called you Lord." And he says, "I don't know you. Get away from me." Right? Now that's the key phrase right there, "I don't know you," because this is God, who's omniscient, has all knowledge. So it can't be a knowledge of knowing of me, right? He knows of Eric Simmons. In that particular context, as the omniscient God, it has to be a "I don't know you" relationally. So the hard truth is, the scary truth is, it's possible for us to profess a saving relationship with Christ and profess a faith in Jesus Christ, and it only be one-sided. Right? And that's a scary reality to be in. But Jesus makes it clear. Not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," not everyone who professes me as Lord is going to enter the kingdom of heaven. And then he comes right behind that, "But only those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven are the ones that will enter." Right? So the question becomes, okay, so what's the will of the Father? What's the will of the Father? Well, you got to go back all the way to Genesis. First thing that God says to us in Genesis, does anybody remember me? He says, "Hey, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. I want my image bearers all over the earth worshiping. Fill the earth. Cultivate the garden, right? culture, make things, develop my creation, make it better, let humanity flourish, do all these things. That's the first thing he said to us. And then Adam and Eve make the great decision that we all make. God's holding out on me. I think I can do better. So they get kicked out of the garden. The fall comes into play. Of course, we're all familiar with the Christian narrative. And just like humans do, we get to the Tower of Babylon and they still are refusing to do what God told them to do. God told them to spread. And what do they do at the Tower of Babylon? We just want to stay right here together. So God does what God does. I'll force this upon you. I'm going to confuse your language to where you can't have community. Languages come into life, come into play. And then just like we still do today, when we can't communicate, we tend to separate. Right? And then fast forward to Matthew. Jesus shows up on the scene. And what do we get? We get the Great Commission, which is nothing more than the great commandment, right? The cultural mandate, the cultural commandment of Genesis 2, restated in a fallen world. In Genesis 2, we populate the earth with image bearers through progeny, through reproduction, because sin's not in the world. Sin's now in the world. We can't do that anymore because it passes through to our children. So how do we populate the world, fill the world with image bearers that will worship God? We have to make disciples of all nations. We have to go to them. We have to assimilate them into the body, baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Teach them to obey the commandments, right? All these good things. And we've gotten to a place, obviously, to where we've made Christianity something that you just say and kind of think that it's true. The problem is, though, is that that type of Christianity is anemic, has no impact, has no influence. Right, and so one of the questions that you know I asked on the preview for this session was this idea of the early church, specifically the church in Rome, and the first, second, and third centuries suffered mass persecution. Persecution in the sense that they were impaled with wooden posts and hung on streets and then lit on fire to light the streets at night with Nero. Right, they were fed to the lions in the Colosseum as entertainment. They were considered atheists because they wouldn't affirm all of the Roman gods. Right, and so they have no political power, they have no prestige, they have no position, they're slaves, they're servants, and they live in poverty for the most case. But by AD 313, Constantine comes onto the stage as an emperor, you know, some legends mixed in with some history, and he has this vision and he declares Christianity to become the Roman religion. The Edict of Milan comes down in 313 and it says you're no longer allowed to torture Christians. You're no longer allowed to persecute them. You're no longer allowed to do any of this. And so we have a church that has gone from isolated, minority, poverty, absolutely no way to influence, according to our standards, who overturns pretty much the largest empire in history, right? And the outcome is not necessarily a positive one. Some would argue that Constantine making the Edict of Milan 313 was the worst thing that's ever happened to the church, right? It's because it's what we see today, right? We're a Christian nation. We forget that there's no such thing. There's a kingdom, and that kingdom encompasses every nation. But what happened with Rome is that we brought in this idea that now there can be a such thing as Christian nation. One, right? The central point. But the problem is that this is what we see in Rome. But what we see today is this. We see the American church that suffers pretty much no persecution, has political power, has prestige, has most of the positions, and has more material prosperity, arguably, than all of history has ever seen. But yet, we're seeing a mass exodus from the church. We have no influence. We have no impact. And we're losing it more and more, faster and faster, in our nation with each year. The big question becomes, why? Because it doesn't make sense. Right? Everything that we're thinking that, well, the reason why they were able to do that is because they were able to influence politics. They were able, they had money, they could fund the mission, they could do this. And all the answers we give is, no, they didn't. Right? Because the difference is that the Edict of Milan wasn't written because Constantine thought that Christians should be given this because he wanted to force this upon the nation. Right? This was a movement that was growing in leaps and bounds, and influence was taking place, and it was getting harder and harder to contain it and to push it down. And so it forced almost this decision that, hey, we better go ahead and recognize this now so we can still kind of keep them in check, or we're going to lose control of this. Whereas in America, we tried the inverse, right? specifically, you know, 60s to the 80s, moral majority. We'll just pass laws that enforce Christian morality, and that's how we'll influence the entire nation, and we'll make it what it's supposed to be. And firm believer, I don't have any like books right now, I'm sure I could find them, but firm believer that most of what we're dealing with right now and the hatred and the vitriol towards the church is because of that. Because we force things through the law to act a certain way, to live a certain way, and now they've gained the powers and the positions to do the opposite. Right? And it's exactly what we're seeing. Laws are now starting to come through. Well, we're going to make this, we're going to make you conform to what we want you to conform to through lawsuits, through laws, through all of this other stuff. Right? And so, why the change though? Why the change? And I think the simple answer is this, because we've stopped teaching the why behind the what of Christianity. We've stopped teaching the why behind the what of Christianity. So a question for y'all is this, is if we're teaching them what Christianity is, why does it matter if we teach them why? Right? The why doesn't save you, it's the what, right? The gospel is what saves you, not why. It's the content, right? It's the truth of it. The fact that Jesus Christ was crucified for our sins, he was buried, he was raised on the third day. That is what saves me. Placing my faith in that, that's what saves me. That's what regenerates my heart. That's what justifies me in Christ. You know, all of the things that we could go through. So why should we teach why? What's the big deal? Is there a big deal?
If it's not reasonable, no one's going to believe it.
If it's not reasonable, no one's going to believe it.
It's not going to have an impact.
Right? It's not going to have an impact. Yes?
I mean, if you think about the things that are like the beliefs that are most treasured that you have, they're not just a belief that you just believe it. Like, you have reasons why. And people buy into why you do something before they even buy what. Often, the why is very important.
Yeah, right? And these beliefs that we have and we treasure, at least from our point of view, they're rational. Right? And just as a side note, when you're trying to do evangelism and you're trying to speak with atheists and this and that, to speak to them in a manner that you portray them as irrational for their beliefs is demeaning, first and foremost, because all of us would say that what we believe to be true in life, we hold that not just because we think we're stupid. We think it's a rational belief to hold. We think it's smart. We think it's wise, or we think it's true. Right? Why else? You think why would be important to teach?
Depth of comprehension.
Depth of comprehension, right? Okay. How many of you ever seen the movie Braveheart? Right? Oh, people, you've got to get out in life. No, just kidding. So Braveheart, whenever I was in high school, it was a really big movie for me. I wrote a report on the main character, so William Wallace, main character in history. Now, the movie is not completely historical. It's got some legend in it, but it does have a lot of historical facts in it, right? And so the first battle, they're getting ready to fight against the English. Whenever all this is getting ready to go down and the English are trying to keep the Scottish kind of in slavery and not free and tyranny's taking place, William Wallace shows up on the scene. The English are on the other side of the hill. It's about three times the size of the army that the Scottish have. And the Scottish aren't even there to fight. Some of them got like sticks, right? They're just trying to look the part so that the elders can kind of walk out and make like this peace treaty and then they can go home, right? But they've got to show that they're like serious about making this fight happen. William Wallace shows up on the scene with his posse. They come in on horses and they're like, that's William Wallace. It's like, no, he's not tall enough. He's 7 feet tall, right? You know, and they got all these legends that they've made up about who William Wallace is. And he comes out in the front and he tells them that he's William Wallace. And then, of course, they well, no, he's 7 feet tall. He's killed people by the hundreds. And, of course, you know, Mel Gibson says, you're right. If William Wallace was here, he could have bolts of lightning out of his eyes and he could have something come out of his hind end, right? But what's the first thing that he does? He gives them the what? What you have to do. You have to fight the English because they are putting you in slavery and you are not free and you have to fight them. He gives them the what. And what's the first thing they say, if you remember? He says, no, we don't. We will run and we will live. Right? Because that's what wisdom says. If we run and live, that's the thing you do. Right? Middle school students still don't get this. Right? But if you run, you will live. And notice what William Wallace comes back with. And I know it's just a movie, so it can break down, right? The illustration always fails somewhere. But he follows up with not more what. He follows up with why. Yes, you will run, you will live. And he says, and whenever you were old and you were dying in your bed, will you replace all of those days of living in tyranny for the one opportunity you could have today to live in freedom. Right? And of course, then the whole place, you know, it's like, dude, you still have sticks. But history tells us, because this was not a legend account on this one, they took the English on that day, outnumbered almost 3-1 by a professional military that was much more equipped, much better funded, much well fed than they were. They were farmers. But they took them. And history has showed us one cool thing about why. People usually win. In a lot of cases, regardless of what reason says should happen, whenever their why is bigger. Right? And Nehemiah reinforces this. Vision is the answer why. Why do we have to do what we have to do? And Nehemiah tells us what the importance of vision is. Without vision, the people will perish. Why? Because they won't move forward. They won't move forward. The why is so important. Not because the why saves you, because it doesn't. The what is what saves you, but the why gives you that oomph. It gives you the reason why it's okay to die for it. It gives you the reason why it's okay to sacrifice for it. My father was a naval officer for 26 years, and so I saw the ships go out many a times for exercises for other nations, even in time of war. Right? And these men and women go out every day, not just in time of war. They willingly put their life in the lines, in war and outside of war, not necessarily for the what, but because they believe that what they're fighting for is so important that it's worth their life. And they'll go for it. Right? And so we've stopped teaching the why behind the what. And so it brings up the interesting question, what is apologetics? Right? And we've answered that. It's giving, you know, saying I'm sorry for God's existence. Right? No, that's not what it is at all. What it does represent, though, is that we're lazy with our words in America. Very lazy. Right? When someone does something wrong, we tell them that they need to give a what? You need to give that person an apology. Right? Which just means you're supposed to say you're sorry. No, what it means is when you give someone an apology is you're supposed to give them the reason why you did it. Right? And that could be the case, but that's the reason. Right? The idea of I'm sorry really has nothing to do with the word apology. Apologia is what it comes from in the Greek. To give a defense or to give an answer. So you're giving a reason why I did it. It was wrong. I know what I did was wrong. But this is why I did it. Or you're giving, that's giving an answer. You're giving a defense. Hey, I know what I did. I don't think it's wrong. And this is why I don't think it's wrong. And I'll do it again if I have to. Right? And so the first thing to understand is that apologetics is not this deep philosophical, I have to go to school and get all this other stuff just to engage in a conversation with an apologetic. It is simply giving a defense or an answer. We do apologetics every day. Every day. We just don't do it for necessarily the right reason. One of the biggest things we engage in from an apologetics perspective, at least my generation, I think it's probably existed longer than that, but is there's two schools in this state that are good at basketball, and there's usually a lot of argumentation that goes on for which one's better. Right? And it's usually heated argumentation. Right? But what do we do when we give these answers? We don't just say, well, it's Duke because I believe it, or it's Carolina because I believe it, and that's just have to believe. It's got to believe they're better. No, we give a reasoned defense. Well, we give it unreasonably, but we give a defense, right? Well, they've got this many championships. They've got this many NBA All-Stars. They've got this. They've got this. And we give evidence for why we're standing where we're at. That's apologetics, folks. That's all it is. It's giving an answer, a defense for what you believe, right? So we do it all the time. The problem that we see in the church is that we do it for all the wrong things. Because we'll lose friendships over a Duke-Carolina rivalry. I know I did until about 5 years ago, and I kind of had the revelation that God cares more about the 10 people on the court than He ever will the program and the 80,000 people in the stadium or the 4,000 people in the stadium than He ever will the program. And that I've got my priorities out of line if I'm willing to lose a relationship or get in a fight with another human being over trying to prove which program's better. I've missed God's point in life, if that's what I'm arguing for. So I still enjoy watching sports. I still like watching the rivalry. But it's become much less of a priority in my life not because I think it's stupid or because I think it's wrong, but because I think people are a bigger priority than the game. And so if I am going to watch the game and spend a lot of time in it, I try to make sure people are with me, and I try to make sure that it's a relationship builder and not a relationship ender, right? And it's the most amazing thing. Like, I was a diehard Carolina fan, and I have actually found that I can find joy in watching Duke play now because it's not about the team. It's about the game, and it's about the people, right? It's not about the game. It's about the people. And everyone knows that Coach K is lost, and everyone knows that Coach Williams is probably lost. All you have to do is watch their life, right? It's not a big deal to give millions of dollars whenever you make millions of dollars every single year. Still your money. It's not that they have to, but it's not, right? Doing good doesn't save us, right? It's what we think Christianity is. We think the gospel is just a moral framework that we put on someone's life, right? So the big thing is, I want us to understand that we do this all the time anyways. So that's the first thing I really want to get across to you today, is that when I'm talking about apologetics, we already do it, right? When you sell your friend on something new at a restaurant, have you gotten the macaroni and cheese at Chick-fil-A yet? Dude, macaroni and cheese is disgusting. What? Are you an American? First of all, how dare you blaspheme Chick-fil-A? Second of all, have you even had the macaroni and cheese? Well, no, I've just... So how are you... What are we doing? We're going right into an argument for why you have no reason to say what you've just said. But when Jesus enters the scene in our conversation, well, I'm not going to argue anybody into heaven. I refuse to debate that. I'm just not going to debate that point. That's a wasted point to debate. But I'll spend 2 hours on macaroni and cheese. You going to hell is not worth me debating or even discussing or trying to convince you otherwise. But eating the macaroni and cheese at Chick-fil-A, buddy, that is eternal. Right? And I'm being very facetious, and I'm kind of speaking a hard truth into the American church right now, but that's where we are in our churches. I'll go to blows for Carolina and Duke, but you can just go to hell if it's going to make me uncomfortable. This is what Peter says. Always be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Remember, context. Christians at this point in time, they're the diaspora. They've been outcasted. They've been pushed out. Extreme persecution is going on for them. And Peter, as a pastor, a shepherd, he's trying to speak back into their life. He's trying to help them process extreme persecution. Right? And so when we think through this, always be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that's in you. Always be ready to answer why. Why do you believe what you believe? Because the Bible said it. In a culture that thinks the Bible is junk, that's not really an answer. Well, that's their problem, not mine. No, that's actually your problem, because God's put them in your life to lead them to Christ. And giving an answer like that's their problem, not mine, is not a gospel focus. And in some cases, I'd even make the argument that you're more unchristlike than they are. Right? Because it is our problem, because these are people God once redeemed. It is my problem that my neighbors are lost. It is my problem they don't believe in the Bible. It is my problem that they don't love the things of God. And the reason why it's my problem is because I've confessed Jesus Christ to be Lord. And I've assumed His values. He's given me His values. He owns me. He's extended His righteousness to me, and He's gave me a command. Right? And Paul even says it in Philippians 2:5. Have the mind of Christ. And he goes into one of the most beautiful Christological hymns we get in Philippians 2:5 through 11. Having the mind of Christ, submit yourselves, who being in the very image of God, lowered himself to the lowest point that he possibly could. This is my paraphrase version. Lowered himself to the very point that he could, to death on a cross, death on a tree. And then was super exalted back up to the Father, the right hand of the Father, and the Father put all authority under him. Right? And so Jesus goes from the highest position that none of us will ever have, lowers himself to a position that none of us will ever reach if we have faith in him, just so we can have the possibility and opportunity to respond in faith to a gospel that we didn't earn or deserve. It's our problem that the culture doesn't believe the way they do and the things they don't believe about the Bible. And our hearts have to get to a point that we're willing to start stepping into the conversations and having the hard questions and learning how to speak to our neighbor and speak truth into their lives. I tweeted this out the other day because I think this is big. While help is something that we all need from time to time, it's hope that we need daily. And for many, sadly, their hope is in something temporary that will fail them. Help is temporary, and if that's all we give people, we'll fail them. There's a book called Toxic Charity, and that's pretty much its whole premise, is that the American church comes in, throws money at it, and temporarily helps a village, or temporarily helps a people in a foreign nation, or temporarily helps a situation of poverty, but does nothing to sustain them or to see them flourish. They throw a bunch of money at it because we have a bunch of money to throw at it, and instead of establishing some type of structure and establishing a partnership or this and that, we give them money and make them dependent upon us for that money, and when the money goes away, so does their ability to do anything else. Right? And so the question becomes, well, you know, it's their responsibility to kind of get this stuff. And it is, right? We have to be willing to work for our own stuff also, right? But hope is what gets you to that place, right? Now, the American dream is the antithesis to the gospel because it goes against everything Jesus said about the individual and about the community and humanity as a whole. Right? Because the gospel says my responsibility is to seek the flourishing of all humanity, of all nations, of all ethnicities. Right? The gospel tells me that my success, whatever that may look like, is not for me and not for mine. It's for me to magnify the Father in heaven and to reach the nations for the cause of Christ. Right? The American dream is not evil in itself, so don't misunderstand what I'm saying, but when it comes in contradiction to the scriptures and we choose it over the scriptures, we have a problem. Right? But here's the deal. The American dream gives us hope. Wrongly placed hope, but it gives us hope. And this is kind of the American way, right? This is the reason why people want to be here. This is why they fight to come. This is why they'll cross the border illegally. Because of hope. Because I know that if I can get across that border, or I know that I can take a risk and I can lose everything, but I have a way of being able to get back on my feet and be taken care of, and man, I can become successful and I can provide for my family. That's hope. That's why we do that. In war, soldiers have hope. Hope that what I'm doing is going to make a difference. And so they run that line. Right? Hope is what moves people forward to make an impact and influence. Not help. Help is what we do along the way as they chase hope. Right? But the problem is that in the church and in America in general, we've placed our hope in the wrong thing. We've placed it in something that can't satisfy and can't deliver ultimately. Right? And so, I say right a lot, by the way. It's kind of my filler. That's not really, I think I'm not calling for amens, just to be clear. But, you know, yeah, and that's, if you want to say an amen, I'm fine with that. I just want to be clear. Right's my filler. So, it's not really calling for some type of answer to it necessarily. But, and so you think about this, then apologetics is not arguing with someone about faith. Right? If I wanted to reword that to say what it is, it is an argument given for your faith. And there's a difference. Like, we equate arguing and fighting as the same thing, and they're not. Fighting is irrational and usually screaming and yelling and doing all this other stuff and attacking each other personally and going after past habits. And that's fighting, right? And we've labeled it arguing. Again, Americans being lazy with language. Giving an argument is just a structured reason for why I'm standing where I'm at, right? And of course, I know no one argues in the church. Like, no one argues with their spouses. That's why we call it intense fellowship, right, at home, because that's just what happens at home, right? But me and my wife, we argue. But the idea being is that, you know, being in disagreement is not necessarily a bad thing if you're trying to work towards something positive. It's how we do it, right? Giving a reasoned argument. So if think about it this way. If I was challenged on the point that God doesn't exist, that the universe is eternal, and you know, God doesn't need to be in the picture, so I would probably push to what's called a cosmological or a beginning type argument for the existence of God, right? And I would say it this way: I'd say, well, hey, reason tells us that everything that we say that exists came into existence, right? You don't just walk down and the street, and all of a sudden a lion just pops right in front of you, and it's like, I mean, where'd that line come from? Well, obviously, it's just not a big deal. We don't need an answer. No, we need answers, right? First of all, it's a line, right? Second of all, it doesn't just come out of nothing. No one would say that, that it just comes out of nothing. And so anything that begins to exist has a cause. That's just reasonable, right? The universe began to exist. They'll agree with that. The Big Bang tells them that. We went from nothing to a singularity, or nothing to here was everything, right? So the universe has a cause. And nothing can't be a cause, right? I always like to joke around, like, dude, I wish nothing would be in my bank account if nothing's what created this universe. Right? Unfortunately, when I look at my bank account and there's nothing in there, it means there's nothing in there. Right? And so it's not arguing with someone about faith. It's just giving a defense. I'm just trying to give you an answer. Why do I believe? This is what Peter's talking about. Why do I have this hope? Here it is, right? So a couple things to know about apologetics, a couple truths, right? And how it fuels discipleship. The first thing is this, is that it's a lifestyle. Apologetics is a lifestyle. It's not just giving an argument. It's a lifestyle. It's the way we live. You look at 1 Peter 3, 13 through 18, and you kind of see this take place, right? And so I'll read it for us. 1 Peter 3, 15 or 14, he says, "But even if you should suffer for righteousness, you are blessed." He says, "Do not fear what they fear or be disturbed, but honor the Messiah as Lord in your hearts. Always be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. However, do this with gentleness and respect, keeping your conscience clear, so that when you are accused, those who denounce your Christian faith will be put to shame." How do you put someone to shame that accuses you of something false? Action that is already present in the community and they know to be false. Words don't get you past accusations. Reputation gets you past accusations. Right? Doesn't mean it's always the case, but right? You think about, like, if your pastor was accused of something, most of us would give him the benefit of the doubt. Why? Because of reputation. But if your pastor's already been doing stuff that's questionable, that you're already calling into question, whether publicly or privately, and an accusation comes, words are not going to save him at that moment. Right? It's the same thing with our Christian testimony. So that when you are accused, notice when you are accused, those who denounce your Christian faith will be put to shame. And he says, "For it's better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil." Right? It's better to suffer for doing good. Why would you suffer for doing good if it's a one-time act? You wouldn't. Why would they attack you if it's a one-time deal? Most of the time, they don't, unless they're trying to make a national case of it. Right? But on the church level, most of the time, you come in contact with an atheist, you come in contact with your community or this and that, most of the time a church that's being attacked is either a mega church that has caused rifts, either justifiably or not, or they're causing rifts in a good way, right? They're actually impacting the community and the people of power aren't getting what they want. Or you have your issues to where I'm getting attacked because of who I am. It's just that simple, right? The gospel is an offensive message. And the fact that people aren't offended by it in America reveals the gospel that we haven't been preaching. Right? But it's not offensive in its delivery. Because what did he just say? You do so in gentleness and with respect and with a good conscience. And so it's not this idea of I'm just going to tell everybody they go to hell and cut their knees out from under them and just be a jerk. That's not okay. That's not Christian. Right? That's also not the gospel necessarily. But the gospel is offensive in and of itself. I mean, think about it. How many of you in here like being called wicked? I don't. I mean, somebody comes up to me, "Hey man, you are wicked," right? And I'm not talking about like you're good at something. Like you are evil and you are a terrible person and your heart is deceitful and you're a liar, you're a cheat, and you, right? That's about the time you lose your teeth, right? But is that not the message? What? That's the message. Right? But then you can have like the infamous, the Pauline, the Apostle Paul's, you know, his infamous, "But." This is who you are. But. This is who God is. And you know what he says about all this? He hates it. But he loves you enough that he took the responsibility to overcome all of this if you just trust him. See, the only offensive part of the gospel is the first segment. The entire world wants hope. If Christian message is true, which I'd make a strong argument that it is, they instinctively want hope because we've all fallen from the garden. We're all just trying to get back to the garden. That's all what the world's doing. Right? And so it's offensive because it brings to reality who we really are, and we're trying to get away from that. We don't want the world to know that. But it's not offensive in the sense that when we give you the hope behind the butt of what can happen. But here's the thing. The reason why it continues to offend people is because in a lot of cases they can't understand the second part of the message because they see none of that in the church's life. The church does a great job on the first side. Right? Hellfire and damnation. Great job. But it's created an entire generation that has no idea what mercy and grace looks like. And so now a culture that refuses to conform to Christian ways are getting hellfire and damnation messages and approaches because this generation has no idea what mercy and grace really is. I have a family member who's a homosexual, and he shared with me the experiences of what happens when he tries to go to church. He admits that it's wicked and it's despicable and it's disgusting and he doesn't want to do it. He says, but I refuse to go to church where it should be the one place and I can feel like that I have some type of hope because I'm sick and tired of the comments that are made and the people that look at me and say the things that they've said to me. You know, and the beauty of the message for my testimony is that I didn't know that my family member was a homosexual until after I had came to Christ. And then here's the message of the gospel for mercy and grace, right? The same sacrifice that happened on the cross and the resurrection covered the whoredom of heterosexuality the same that it covers the whoredom of homosexuality. Equally. Right? And what we have to understand as a church is that we don't get to make the choices necessarily of who we are or what we want to do. Because the greatest question is for the heterosexuals is how come you don't like the same gender? Right? If it's so easy for them to choose the opposite gender, why is it not so easy for you to choose the same? Doesn't justify the behavior, doesn't justify their choice. But it does put a new light on the idea of the mercy and grace that needs to be extended and given to them, right? And so I'll give you this one for free because I think it's important. The world doesn't hate Christianity because we're hypocrites in the sense that we understand it, because we're all hypocrites. The standard's perfection. Has anyone met that in here? I don't think, right? We're all hypocrites by definition, if we hold to that definition, right? Because that's the standard, perfection. None of us reach that, right? I don't think the world hates us for that reason. I think the world hates Christianity or the message that we bring because we know the standard's perfection. We know we can't meet it. We know the grace and mercy that's given to us for it in light of the imperfections we have. But then we hold the world to the standard of perfection as if the grace and mercy that we have doesn't apply to them. And they know that. Nobody takes out notes at home whenever you tell your family, hey guys, I want to talk to you about how I'm imperfect. Like my wife doesn't pull out a notebook and be like, hold on, I want to make sure I write this down so I can remember. Your children don't do that either. You ever want to know where you're really at with Christ, ask your 8-year-old, hey honey, how do you think daddy's doing with following Jesus? Truth. Right? It's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle, and it includes two things. It involves good and persecution. Good and persecution. So doing good things. So when they accuse you, when they try to shame you, right? You're doing good. You have a good, you're not just doing a good thing, you're living a life of good. And so when they come to attack you, they're put to shame. But at the same time, when you're doing a life of good and you're pushing back against the prince and the power of this world in this moment, right? Persecution is what comes. Persecution is what comes. If we're going to be faithful in our submission to Jesus Christ and His commission of making disciples of the nations in the midst of a hostile world, when we do good over and over and over and we continue to love people unconditionally, we continue to serve them unconditionally, and we continue to walk with them unconditionally, they're either going to fall in love with what you have or they're going to hate you. It's the two options, right? It's the way the heart works. That's why we refuse help sometimes. That's why we won't ask for help at times, because we don't want you to do good for me because I can do it myself. Because when you do good for me, what are you revealing to an extent in my life? That there is bad or there's something I can't do, right? And so it's, you know, good and persecution. It's a lifestyle. But here's the second thing it leads us to. It leads us to this. It's a commitment. It's a commitment. Whenever you know that you can be impaled on a wooden post and covered in tar and lit on fire to light the streets, or you can be fed to the lions for sharing your faith or standing your ground for there being one true God, you have to be committed. Right? You got to be committed. You got to know why you believe what you believe, and you got to be sold on it. Because other than that, it don't make sense to offer yourself to the lions. It doesn't make sense to offer yourself the possibility of being impaled and lit on fire. That doesn't make sense. That's what fools do. But if it does make sense, and it is a rational belief, and it lines up with history, and it lines up with the evidence that history gives us is true, then I got to sell out to it. I got to commit to it. When the persecution comes, hope is what gets me through that persecution. Because I know what I've got's true, and I'm not backing off of it. And the difficult thing about the gospel is that in the same time that I'm being persecuted, I'm also still called to serve the people that are persecuting me. And this is where the American dream and the gospel start hitting each other in the head. Christians aren't called to protect their borders and turn refugees away and to hate people that hurt us. Americans are. Christians aren't. We were all refugees as Gentiles. Jesus didn't put borders up. And this is where the difficulty comes. The other difficulty comes is that we've created a culture that all of you think of as switched into a political realm. Now he's just
meddling.
That's right. He's just meddling, right? But does the gospel not speak to how we treat refugees? Does it not speak to how we're supposed to reach the nations? Here's a crazy argument to think about. Maybe the American church is failing so bad at doing what God commanded them to do, that like he's done throughout history, he's forcing his commission upon them now by bringing the nations to them. And this is where we come into collisions. I'm not anti-American. I'm the son of a naval officer. I've watched the caskets come home. I've watched the flags have to get burnt when they've dropped. I've watched the ships leave. I've watched the planes go. I know what it means to be an American. And I'm thankful that I live in this nation. I'm thankful for this nation. But my citizenship primarily is in heaven.
That's right.
Secondly, it's in America. And when my American citizenship conflicts with my heavenly citizenship, the rules of the kingdom overrule the rules of this nation. Why we're at where we're at is because we've lost the why. We know the what, for the most part. But we've lost the why, and it's a commitment to trust in God. It's a commitment to testify of God, and it's a commitment to do right by others. You trust in God because you trust that there is a life after this, and that heaven is my home, and that magnifying the Father for eternity is what I'm called to do. It's what I'm supposed to do, and you trust God in that, and that helps you move forward. And while you're trusting Him in that, you testify of what He is and who He is and what He's done for you and for the nations. Then we do right by others, regardless of what it cost us. All of the major movements that have happened in this world for the good have came primarily from the church. And it came at their lives to make it happen. It's a famous quote, I can't remember where it's from, but it says that the history of the church is written in red. Right? And unfortunately, the church has got a bad rap because some of the stuff the church has done in church history has not done right by others that they've declared in Jesus' name is the right way to do things. Right? That's when we weren't teaching the what correctly or fully. So it's a commitment to trust in, to testify, and do right by others. And it includes setting apart the Lord God in our hearts and testifying of our hope with gentleness, respect, and a good conscience. We got to understand that we're going to try to reach this world. If we talk about atheists, right? So atheists will sit over here on the spectrum. And we want atheists to go from right here to Christian theism. And when they don't, we think they're foolish or they're irrational or they're something of that nature. Right? But I want you to think about what an atheist has to go through in order to get to be a Christian theist. They have to give up everything that they hold true to be about this world to move over to Christian theism. So my friend Rob Sherman was the most prolific atheist in the state of Illinois. Became friends in November of 2009. Rob has since died in a plane crash. I don't know that he ever came to Christ, but for 7.5 years we had gospel conversations. Drove 9 hours one time when I was in Nebo, Kentucky, speaking at a church just so that we could hang out. And we hung out in his RV, drove all night to get there, hung out in his RV, had an amazing conversation for about 2.5 hours, right? I don't know if Rob is in hell. I don't know if he's in heaven. I know that he had all the information he needed to be in heaven. But here's what I'm asking Rob. Rob, I need you to believe that your parents, who have since died, are both in hell. Your daughter will go to hell. Your son will go to hell. Your wife will go to hell also. Hey, come on over to our side, because that's the best thing you could do, brother. Be like us asking to give up the belief that there is heaven and that we don't just return to the dirt and that this whole life is pointless and there's just no reason. Just give it up because all this stuff is stupid. You're wasting your time. We got to understand that we have to give them a why to get past this. And that's a big one. And atheists don't always just become Christian theists. They go through a process. They become an atheist who's maybe less, they start doubting their atheism. And then they maybe become an agnostic who leans towards atheism. And then maybe an agnostic who leans towards deism. That, you know, okay, maybe a God started it, but we don't know who this is. Or maybe, you know, a polytheist. Well, maybe there's a bunch of gods, you know, or something of that nature. To just a theist. Okay, no, there is a personal God. To Christian theism. That is a process that you have to walk with someone through. And that is a dirty process. Right? Atheists don't have the moral compass you do all the time. It's funny, you know, actually most atheists that you run into, if you try to reach out to atheists, you'll find that they actually act more Christian than Christians do. Alvin Reed, I think you guys got a book from him today at Southeastern. He says this, he said, I'd much rather have atheists as my neighbors in my community because they'll actually do what they'll say they'll do when you're not in town. Right? I mean, we say that facetiously, but we all know that that's true. Right? And that's the sad part. And so with gentleness, respect, and a good conscience, and so we understand the best apologetic is not an argument to be given, but it's a life to be lived. It's living this faith out. We don't have problems with friends disagreeing with us most of the time. Even if we disagree with them, we don't have a problem with them disagreeing with us. Right? We even have relationships with friends we disagree with. But why can we do that? Because they're our friend. Why do we even listen to what they have to say even if we think it's irrational? Because they're our friend. Because we respect them. Because we know them maybe. Right? Whatever the case may be, but when I was growing up, I wasn't a very easy child. My mom and dad exhibited mercy and grace to me that helped me understand what mercy and grace looks like. I was the poster child for ADD. Whenever hyperactivity wasn't in the title, it was attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity back in the late 80s. And I put them through a lot. Burnt down woods, beat kids up, destroyed cars. There's a lot of stuff I went through, right? My dad, to this day, we don't always agree about things. But you know why I always give my dad an audience? Because he has demonstrated to me over the entire course of my life that he is for me, that he loves me, despite of my stupidity. So I don't always agree with Dad, but you know what he will always get from me because of that? Not because he's my dad, but because of the lifestyle that he showed me, is a hearing. And it's amazing. The world does the same thing. The world does the same thing. And here's where We kind of get into discipleship. When our faith is being lived out daily, when people can see that it's real and that it exists on Monday through Saturday, we gain credibility with others. We gain confidence to share our faith because we see it lived out. We see God working. And we have opportunities to teach others to do the same. You know why? Because the world is hungry for what we say we have. And when they see it, they want it. Now, they may end up rejecting it once they find out what it really is, but they want what they see when it's actually lived out, right? Dr. Robinson said this about discipleship. He said, to rightly order the worship of another. A lot of definitions out there, but to rightly order the worship of another. We come into a relationship with Christ. Just because we receive Christ and are saved doesn't mean our priorities are in line, right? I think that's a fair statement. So what's the responsibility of the one discipling somebody to make disciples? I have to rightly order their worship. I have to teach them what it looks like to have a life that is rightly ordered according to the Scriptures. Jesus Christ is first. And this is what it means to follow Him in evangelism. This is what it means to follow Him in giving. This is what it means to follow Him in prayer. This is what it means to follow Him in disagreement. This is what it means to follow Him in discipline. This is what it means to... And we run the entire... This is what it looks like to follow Jesus Christ. Now take everything I've given you and go do it to someone else. Rightly order their worship. And if we're going to do this, then we have to teach other believers what we believe, right? We got two slides and we're over. 2 Timothy 2:2, Paul's writing to Timothy, son of the faith, and what you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, commit to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Timothy gives them the what? And what you have heard in the presence of many witnesses, be able to give, commit to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. So Paul settled his why for following Jesus. This has already happened for Paul. He's settled. I think Road to Damascus would probably maybe settle all of us. But it's settled for him. His why is answered. And because of this, he understood the importance of sharing the what of his beliefs with others. And he also understood the importance of sharing the why, as we see throughout the Scriptures. You want to see where Paul's big whys are? Blah, 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 blah. Therefore. Because of what? Therefore, here's why. It's why you should do it. Right? Paul was willing to be challenged in his faith, his apostleship, and his words in general because he knew the what behind the why. But he also knew the why behind the what. And when you're settled in your why, your how and what will be very difficult to shake. And so it all comes down to this right here. Apologetics is going to fuel effective discipleship in the church. And the reason why it's going to fuel effective discipleship is because it's going to put the why, it's going to put the passion back into the purpose. But also, right, as a result, effective discipleship must include the teaching of effective apologetics. And as I've shown you, hopefully clearly, if I've done my job, we're not talking about upper-level PhD academic arguments. We're talking about a life committed to Christ, according to the Scriptures, lived out daily. And teaching people why you're willing to do that. And even giving an argument for why you're willing to do that. And so you think about it this way. As unbelievers, the question that's answered for us first in our coming to faith in Christ is the what. What are you asking me to believe in? Right? As this guy said right here. But the immediate question after that that actually gets me to faith in Christ is why should I believe this? We give you the what. But the question always follows, why? Why should I believe this? But as believers, and here's the switch. As believers, the question that Peter is telling us to make sure we answer for others first is why do I believe in this? And once I've answered that for the other person, then I tell them the what of my beliefs. If we want to fulfill the Great Commission, have a lasting impact in our cultural context, we're going to have to return to practicing and teaching apologetics. When the church was having influence and impact all throughout history, it was being taught. The why was being answered. Father, I thank you for the morning and the afternoon that you've given us. I thank you for this conference. I pray your blessing upon all the churches.